Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If there's one place that people still expect a reasonable amount of privacy, it's the doctor's office. But according to journalist Adam Tanner, maybe they should not. In the world of Google and big data, he explains that every drug you're prescribed, every blood test, every step on that scale, it's all recorded. And that data has created a multi-billion dollar business, one where your most intimate data is aggregated and then sold to companies that have nothing to do with your treatment. Tanner explains how this happens in his new book, Our Bodies, Our Data, how companies make billions selling our medical records. He's also a writer in residence at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard, but he joins us today from the studios of KUAC in Fairbanks, Alaska. Adam Tanner, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello.
It's great to have you. So first of all, how is it possible that any data gets collected and used without our knowledge? Because I thought we had a Healthcare Privacy Act.
So data that removes your name and certain key identifiers about you is allowed to be sold and gathered into dossiers about you. So you go into the doctor's office, you close the door, you tell the doctor your intimate problems. The doctor sends you to the pharmacist. He sends you to a blood test. All of this is recorded in insurance claims. All of those things can be commercially sold if your name is removed. Now, the issue here is if there's years of information about you held by a commercial data gatherer of some kind, that it may be possible to re-identify you and possibly use that information against you. So interestingly, this trade has developed in dramatic ways in recent years, but patients don't know about it, and often doctors do not know about it, or pharmacists or people administering the blood tests, all those healthcare providers we meet in this system.
Okay, so you said it may be possible to re-identify you, but I thought that the records were supposed to be effectively stripped of identifying information, right?
So the information in the record still has your date of birth, your section of town that you live in, your doctor's name is included in there, your gender. So if you had years of information about someone, you would be able to recognize them perhaps from the file. So take me as an example. I'm teaching for a year in Fairbanks, Alaska. Before that, I was in the Cambridge area. Before that, I was in Belgrade, Serbia. I may be the only person of my age to have been in those three places over those years. So if you just had that basic information, you would be able to pick me out from the file. Thanks to the cheap storage and amazing computing, you can find the needle in the haystack.
Well, we'll talk about who's aggregating and selling this information in a second, but who's buying it?
So typically this is used to promote the sale and marketing of drugs. So the biggest buyer of this all will be the big drug companies.
And they use it for?
So they create several different kinds of profiles. There are doctor-identified profiles. They know that your doctor typically prescribes a certain drug. Drug A, for example. And if you work for drug company B, you may want to send a representative to tell them how great drug company B is and their offerings. So they specifically know and can specifically target doctors based on the prescribing patterns. For patients, there's several different kinds of data that's gathered about you. There's this anonymized data. There's also identified data about you that's collected outside of the doctor's office, things that you do that are not covered by HIPAA, the rules on medical data, things you do on the internet, products that you buy, things you say on social media, your fitness devices that you wear, trackers, things like that. All of that data can be openly sold with your name. And then that allows marketing companies to figure out what types of patients may be most likely to suffer certain ailments. So it's all about sales and marketing, but it's often intrusive in a way that you may not expect.
Huh. Now, you spoke with pharmacy chains about selling patient data. Who did you speak with and what did they tell you?
Companies who sell data are typically quite reluctant to talk about this in great detail. It's very lucrative for most of the players on the chain, with the exclusion of the patients who do not benefit in any way from this. But I've talked to, building this history over the past 50 years, how this industry developed, I've talked to hundreds of different officials, past and present, who confirm this trade is taking place. For a company such as CVS or a big drug company, they make tens of millions of dollars a year. That's not a huge amount for such a huge company, but it is a percentage extra onto their bottom line profits. It's worth taking. They'd rather not discuss these kind of things in great detail typically. They'd rather keep quiet. And they are fully abiding by the law, which allows this trait.
Right. So that's the interesting thing, because your book focuses on one health information data mining company in particular. It's called IMS. Now, tell us a bit about them. They started back in the 1950s, right? But they weren't necessarily, I mean, in the 1950s, there wasn't really any data mining, healthcare data mining business to speak of. But how did this company become what it is today?
So IMS Health, which has recently renamed itself to Quintiles IMS, got its start in the 1950s. It was started by a German immigrant to New York City who headed one of the biggest medical advertising firms. There was a big boom in medical advertising. He was quite a secretive person, and he was in a secret alliance with his biggest rival, Arthur Sackler, a name that may be familiar to Boston area listeners because of the Sackler collection at the museum at Harvard. Mm-hmm. The two of them together secretly formed this company, IMS Health, which initially is just measuring what drugs are selling well in different markets. They start in Germany, they expand in Europe and come to the United States. Over time, though, in more recent years, long after the Froelich and Sackler are dead, they start gathering this information about individual patients. And so in recent years, they've been able to build these dossiers. They have more than 500 million dossiers about individual patients worldwide. Their dossiers are anonymized, but as I say, they contain a lot of intimate personal information.
Yeah. So we actually have a clip here from one of IMS Health's promotional videos. We should say this is one that they've posted on YouTube. And I just wanted to play it because here's how the company itself sees the business that it's in.
Researchers need to identify treatment gaps to develop more targeted novel medicines. Hospitals must understand the total patient experience to improve the efficiency and quality of care. We deliver a comprehensive view of treatments, costs, and outcomes.
So, Adam Tanner, I mean, these are things that sound useful and could increase the quality of care overall for everybody in the healthcare system, for better research, better standards at hospitals. They're describing things that are good.
So data miners describe their business as being something that will help advance medicine, lead to new incredible breakthroughs in solving disease and coming up with new medication. So far, that's not happened. There's been interesting insights and cost analyses that have come from the studies, but no major breakthrough. And the way of traditionally researching medicine with two different groups taking different drugs, a placebo, and having a double-blinded study, these remain the standards that are bringing the breakthroughs. Ultimately, what I'm trying to do with this book, Our Bodies, Our Data, is encourage a discussion about what is the best approach to our medical data. What has happened is that commercial companies have decided for themselves, with very little public discussion, what's best to do with our medical data. Now, all over the United States and in places like Boston in particular and the environs, you have lots of great researchers who are doing very good work using data and other means to try to solve disease, gain new insights. A lot of people would gladly contribute to those efforts if they had control over their data. I think patients should have control of their data, both anonymized and named. And if you want to help science, and I think many people would, you would be able to donate to those programs. So I think we should encourage science to go forward, but I don't think we should let industry in and of itself decide what's best for everybody without telling them about it.
But let me ask you, Adam Tanner, I mean, look, personally, I am very sympathetic to any efforts to monitor the whittling away of our privacy. But I've yet to hear I wasn't quite sure I saw in your book any evidence of any harm having been done, especially from this anonymized data, even as it's bought and sold and used by different companies. Is there any evidence of harm having been done?
I think the greatest harm ultimately, as people realize that there is a big commercial trade in their data, is the confidence in the system itself. You might be less willing to tell your doctor everything and be fully candid about your problems if you knew that someone else was, in essence, listening in on that conversation. Imagine if you went to a priest or another religious official and you gave confession or told them intimate facts. That information anonymized would be fascinating for social scientists, as would true details from a tax accountant's office or from a criminal defense attorney's office. But the nature of that conversation, of that interaction, would change if you knew that that information was in commercial circulation. And I fear the same is ultimately true with our information. If we understand that it is being sold at every turn, it may undermine the confidence in the system. So I think that's the most important point. There are people who receive direct advertising. There are people who have been harmed from this. There could be people denied life insurance, people denied various benefits, discriminated against in various ways. Even since writing this book, various people who've worked for companies that gather data have called me to say that even though they're in the industry, they are concerned about these practices and think it will lead to discrimination, to workers being fired, and so on.
Yeah.
So there's certainly some real risks that exist with wide circulation of patient data for commercial purposes.
Now, some states have tried to change state law to account for the information that you've been talking about. I mean, New Hampshire was the first state, right, to take a stand against companies like IMS. They have something called the Prescription Information Confidentiality Act, passed back in 2006. What happened there?
So in many cases of this trade in patient-related data, people along the way have not known about it. So doctors for many years did not know that there was a commercial trade in their data that identified which prescriptions that they were writing. So when doctors caught wind of this, several states in New England passed legislation barring these commercial doctor-identified profiles. Companies such as IMS and other data miners fought back. The case went to the Supreme Court, and ultimately the court ruled that they had a First Amendment right to trade this data.
A First Amendment right to trade the data. Okay. And so,
but if you redefine what data is, if you said information about patients, whether it's identified or not identified, is protected by HIPAA or whatever successive laws we have, that would be a different story. You could protect certain kinds of intimate data. That's what I think we should have a discussion about.
I see. Now, you speak in the book, Our Bodies, Our Data, you speak with an activist, Deborah Peel. She's created a group called Patient Privacy Rights, and she argues that there's no chain of custody for health data. And what exactly does she mean by that? And would it even be possible to change that reality?
So again, if we go back to this example, you're talking to your doctor, you think only your doctor knows. You're talking to the pharmacist, you think only that person knows. But what happens is what you think would be a one-to-one transaction is actually going to many, many different people. There's research done at Harvard that shows a site, thedatamap.org. It shows you a cluster of many, many different sites of all the places the data goes, many more than you can expect. And often to places or entities that you think you have no association with. There was a big data breach from the health insurer Anthem a few years ago. Almost 80 million people lost their lost information about them through this breach. I was one of those people, but I had no relationship with Anthem whatsoever. Doing some research, I realized that a former employer passed on that information to someone else who passed it on to Anthem, who was then hacked, and now my data would be in circulation. So this chain of custody of where your data comes from is quite interesting because it's in wide circulation in places you don't expect, and then it can be vulnerable to hacking or other kinds of misuse.
So it makes me wonder, is there anything that patients, individuals can do who don't want their information shared, whether or not it's anonymized? I mean, what you just said makes me think that it's impossible to keep your information from getting out there.
Well, there's a couple different issues. The security against hacking in the medical sphere is not as strong as it is in the financial sphere. So certainly from the doctor's level to the hospitals to big insurers, we need to see stronger levels of protection and security. For an individual concerned about the privacy of their information, you could choose insurers or doctors who do not use entities that share their data with commercial people. So, for example, Aetna does not share or does not sell claims forms. There are certain electronic health records that do not share claims forms. But it's very hard for an individual to pick and choose healthcare providers based upon who's sharing data or selling the data. I think a preferable way would be to empower patients to have control of their own records and then decide with whomever they want to share it. The other irony, of course, is that we would like to have full access to our own records for our own medical treatment, but that doesn't exist right now.
Right.
So if something happens to me here in Alaska, they don't have access to my Boston area medical records. So the stuff we want for our own care is not present, and the stuff we may not desire, the commercial circulation of a dossier about us, is in circulation.
Well, Adam Tanner is a writer in residence at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University. His new book is Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. Adam Tanner, it's been very eye-opening speaking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks very much. I also have a website, adamtanner.news, and Data Curtain is the Twitter handle.
Thank you. We'll link to all of that at our website, radioboston.org. Let's turn now to the Remembrance Project. Writer Alyssa Eli's look at the extraordinary lives of people in our community. Today, Eli remembers a Connecticut man with several hobbies and one deep passion.
Paul Harris loved desserts so much, he thought about buying a Carvel ice cream franchise in Connecticut back when he was running a moving van company there. He loved bridge so much, he became a master-level player. But his greatest love, aside from his wife of 65 years and five children, was golf.
When I was a kid, when he got a hole-in-one, like, the whole golf club would come and, like, there'd be this big celebration, you know, because it's hard to do, especially on a championship golf course.
Sometimes Joy Harris played golf with her father, and in a bid for marital union, her mother learned to play, too. Even the house accommodated him.
When I was growing up in Connecticut, we had this bathroom that my mother decorated in golf motif. So, and it had all my father's trophies in there and all the plaques and everything, but everything in the bathroom was golf oriented. So like the knobs on the sink were golf balls and the towels were all, you know, golf, and the wallpaper was all golf. And I think the carpet was like green, like a, you know, like a green, like a golf green. And so people would come over and, you know, they'd go in that bathroom and they'd be in there for a long time.
After retirement, Paul and his wife moved to a golf community in Florida where he played 3 to 4 times a week. Age and cataracts made precision more difficult, but no less successful. Once in his mid-70s, he teed off with a friend. He knew the shot had landed, though neither of them could see where.
They start walking towards the hole looking for the ball. They couldn't find it. And then his friend said, you know, joking, maybe it's in the hole. And so they went over and it was.
Ball hawking was another passion, a way of scouring for treasure.
He had this outfit that he would wear that was just hysterical. It was sort of like some of his old army clothes, you know, like fatigues and everything. But then he'd have these big rubber boots and this machete, you know, in a golf club.
The machete was for alligators in the water hazards. Paul knew where they lived. Afterwards, he would sort his treasure by quality, clean them with care, and then send his friends egg cartons packed with golf balls. True love is hard to give up, but when he was around 80, Paul did.
One day he just said to me, I'm not going to play golf anymore. Do you want my clubs? But it was harder for me than it was for him. He was ready to move on.
Yet delight was deep in his character, and Paul wasn't finished with love. On a trip to Colorado, Joy and her husband took him up a mountaintop. He gazed at the panorama with old eyes that had become new. If only I'd known there were places like this, he told them, I wouldn't have played so much golf.
Writer Alyssa Eli remembering Paul Harris, who died in August. If you'd like to suggest a loved one for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.